Hello and welcome to Soundtrackin' with me, Edith Bowman, my weekly podcast that's a conversation around music and film. Thanks so much for the lovely feedback over the last couple of episodes. So many lovely messages after the Dave Grohl episode, which was brilliant. It was very sweary, but it was brilliant. I listened to it in the car, actually, the other day. I was on my own, thankfully. Otherwise, my boys would have had a field day. Any excuse to swear, to be honest. What is it about kids finding swearing really interesting? But I like doing that because Ben, who works with me in the podcast, you know, once I record the interviews, I send him the audio and he sort of sprinkles his magic dust on it and adds little bits of music here and there and just makes us sound great, to be honest. And it was such a great listen. I really enjoyed it. I also really enjoyed the Adam McKay episode and had some fabulous feedback about that as well. So thank you very much. And we continue our bumper run of guests on Soundtrackin' with a man who's up for an Oscar this month in the Best Actor category, and quite rightly so. Andrew Garfield delivers a knockout performance as Jonathan Larson in Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical biopic Tick, Tick, Boom. As you can see for yourself right now on Netflix, it is available and I highly recommend that you watch it. It's always a joy chatting to him, though if you haven't seen the latest Spider-Man film, I should say this interview does contain a major spoiler. But I'd also like to add that I imagine you've been living in a rock if you don't know what I'm talking about. Amazingly, Andrew has never been required to sing for a project before this. Not that you'd know it, and we'll begin with one of his numbers from Tick, Tick, Boom, Boho Days.
This is the life of Bo, 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 Bo. This is the life of Bo, 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 Bo. This is the life of Bo, 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 Bohemia. Showers in the kitchen, there might be some soap. Dishes in the sink, brush your teeth if you can cope. Toilets in the closet, you better hope there's a light bulb in there.
That's today.
Revolving door roommates, prick up your ears. 14 people in just 4 years. Ed and Max and Jonathan and Carolyn and Carrie. David, Tim, no, Tim was just a guest from June to January. Margaret, Lisa, David, Susie, Stephen, Joe, and Sam. And Elsa, the bill collector's dream who still is on the lam. Don't forget the neighbors, Michelle and Gay. They're like a family, then a family. Hey, the time is flying and everything is dying. I thought by now I'd have a dog, a kid, and wife. The ship is sort of sinking, so let's start drinking before we start thinking, this is the life. Yes! This is the life, bo 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 bo. This is the life, bo 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 bo. This is the life, bo 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 bo. Bohemia. Bohemia. One more time. Bohemia. Bo 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 bo.
Andrew, this is so great that we get to do this in person. I've been lucky that I've had the chance to chat to you a little bit about this film with Lynn on the weird and wonderful world of Zoom calls that we've been doing over the past year. This is a phenomenal performance and an extraordinary film. But I want to go back, if you don't mind.
Please, to the beginning.
To the very, very beginning. Bugs Him Alone, age 9.
Yeah, Epsom Playhouse. Thank you.
I want to go back to how this was presented to you. How you first approached and what was your reaction to the ask of Tick, Tick, Boom and this character?
Well, the first thing that happened was I was doing Angels in America in New York, and Lin was, you know, in New York because that's his home, and he was on the massage table of our mutual friend Greg Miele, and I've told this story a couple of times, but Greg, it really is one of my best friends in the world, to the point where when Lin asked him, hey, you're friends with Andrew, and he was like, yeah, he's my brother. And then said, well, do you know if I have a thing that I want to talk to him about, do you know if he can sing? And of course, you know, Greg just didn't hesitate and said, yes, he is this untapped resource of singing genius, not having any idea if that was true or not, but, you know, being a good friend, just lied on my behalf. And then, so that was the beginning. And then he kind of checked, he was like, hey, just so you know, Lynn's going to ask you to sing in something, so just act as if you can, because otherwise it's my reputation on the line. And then Lin, he said yes to doing a Q&A for Angels in America for Tony Kushner and myself and the rest of the cast with the director Marian Elliott. And I only later learned that he only said yes to doing that Q&A to get close to me. And I find that hilarious because there was an unnecessary kind of circumnavigating of manipulation to get close to me, where all he had to do was put out the call and I would have been there. And then we had a lunch. But it was one of those things, and it rarely happens. It's happened a few times in my life. One where Mike Nichols asked me to have a word with him, one where David Fincher asked me to have a word with him, and one where Scorsese. It's happened a few times in my life, but it was one of those times where when I heard that Lin wanted to talk to me, it was kind of an immediate yes to whatever it was. Hamilton was so much in my psyche at that time. It was like I was on the subway listening to it every day, and it was just, it felt like a part of me at that point. So I knew whatever he was going to be doing was going to have that level of depth and joy and kind of a richness.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I was right. And he slid across the score for Tick, Tick, Boom, the music and lyrics to Tick, Tick, Boom, and said, this isn't going to make sense to you right now, but I promise you it will. And little did I know that he was introducing me to like a long lost brother in Jonathan Larson that I never got to meet, obviously, while he was alive. But so it proved to be absolutely right. That instinct that, you know, because there are a few elemental kind of people in the world that we get to be alive while they're alive. And Lin is one of them. He's like one of those elemental creative forces that is defining culture in such a kind of, I don't know, in so many seen and unseen ways. Like he is just in the water in the most beautiful. And thank God he's one of those. It's like him, Kendrick Lamar. And like, you know what I mean? Like, thank God there are those soulful people out there who are expressing from that very pure place because we need that soul medicine, and there are not many artists, as we know, that really offer that.
He has this ability to start conversations without, I think, even realizing that he's doing that. Mm-hmm. I think that the creativity is at the heart of what he does, but there's so much more there that I don't think he even realizes a lot of the time, that he's kind of breaking the seal on things and really encouraging people to think about things and really address big questions and big situations.
Yeah, and he holds it so lightly as well. It's a really weird thing, because on paper you would imagine that that kind of person would be carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders and have to have a very kind of serious outlook on life, but it is literally hanging out with your best friend when you were seven, just wanting to show you his new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles backpack. And you know, like I remember being on set and like preparing for the harder scenes of the film. And, you know, the scene where I find out that my best friend is, you know, potentially, you know, really, really sick and dying with an AIDS diagnosis. And, you know, I'm preparing and he's coming up to me, showing me literally like, I don't know, like, you know, the intro song from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And I'm like, dude, I have to be good in this movie that you're directing. He's like, oh, I know, I just don't like to see you sad. Okay, carry on. And I'm like, no, he said, what? Like, it's incredible. It's an incredible thing. And so he does wear it so lightly.
Yeah. So that conversation, he slides across the words and music to Tick, Tick, Boom. What's your reaction? Because back to Bugsy Malone at 9, I'm assuming you sang in that. So you know you've got a voice. No,
I didn't sing it.
Did you not sing it.
I played one of the non-singing roles, and I was fine with that. I played Fat Sam, who doesn't sing.
I played Fat Sam
with a pillow up my shirt. And I would have done craft services on Bugsy Malone at the Epsom Playhouse. Aww. I would have taken anything they would have given me. So I didn't have to sing. I didn't have to test that out.
So you've never used your voice for work in that way before?
In a singing way, no. Oh, no, wow. Never, no. I knew I wasn't tone deaf. And I also, I don't know, I had the desire. I knew I had the desire. Like, music is so important to me. And I think I've kind of harbored a secret longing to be a song and dance man, to be a Fred Astaire, to be a kind, you know, you know, even like, I think about someone like Justin Timberlake, who I just admire so much in terms of the resource that he has with confidence with his, you know, with his instrument, you know, with his body and his voice and how he expresses himself. And yeah, there was a kind of shadow aspect of myself that I hadn't kind of owned. And I knew that it was waiting somewhere. I hoped it was waiting. And I think Lin, you know, we need mentorship, right? To bring those parts of ourselves out that we are maybe afraid don't exist, or maybe they do exist, but we haven't got the courage to reveal them, or it feels too vulnerable. So Lynn and Jonathan, really, through from Beyond the Grave, became that those mentors to me as a singer and as a performer in that way.
Where did you start? Where did you start in terms of the prep for it?
Yeah, I started. We did a workshop. We did three workshops just to work on the script throughout the year. And the first one happened the day after I came, my last performance of Angels in America in New York. And I was very, very angry with Lynn. It kind of like, it was the exact, like, we started as we were meant to go on. That was the amazing thing about Lynn. Was like, no, you can do it. I'm like, wait, no, I can.
But you saw the show. You saw how much I can.
I'd really rather not. And he's like, no, but it's fine. Come on. I'm like, okay. And then I find myself there. And I'm like, how did you get me here? How did you convince me of this? But that's his part of his genius as well. But then really the work began with Liz Kaplan, who is this amazing singing teacher that works with a lot of the great Broadway performers, and including Lynn himself. And I think that was my kind of unofficial audition, mm-hmm. probably, like that she had like a back channel texting with Lynn while I was trying to reach notes in her office in Chelsea in New York. And I think I passed the test after that first session. She was like, yeah, we can get there. We can get there. Right? That was very, very gratifying. But then it was like, you know, it's that wonderful thing where you get the job and you're so happy for 20 minutes. And then you try to extend that and celebrate the idea of what it is to do this job. And then you actually have to do the job and it becomes pure hell in your own head for the next, until it comes out, literally 2 years, because you know that you're constantly kind of walking hand in hand with your self-doubt then for mm-hmm. the rest of time. It's and then you, until the premiere or until it flops or flies, and so yeah, so then it became just a kind of grind, an attempt to gain mastery in things I'd never done before, which were singing and piano and dance, within a year. Wow. And it was, yeah, so I just kind of do. But again, I say that my mentors were Lynn and John, and Lynn, it's obvious how he's a mentor, but John being a mentor is a bit more mystical because it felt like he was just kind of pulling me through from the spirit realm. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it was
totally.
Like that feeling of wanting to honor someone so much, not only in his brilliance, but in his messiness and in his, the cracked parts of his voice
as well. The realness of him.
Exactly. So I think that spiritual mentorship was really what, you know, gave me the need really every day to devote myself to it.
Did you spend much time kind of speaking to, you know, friends and family who were part of his world?
Yeah, definitely. And they were all lining up to talk to him, because there was an amazing article that was written recently by one of his college roommates, this guy Todd Robinson, who's a writer and a director and an actor in his own right and a brilliant one. He wrote, I think it was White Squall was one of the, it was like a Ridley Scott, I think Ridley Scott turned it into a film. I think it was Ridley Scott. But anyway, he wrote this incredible piece about Jonathan. It was in Vanity Fair. I was thinking a bridge version in Vanity Fair recently. I advise anyone who's listening to have a read, because it's that kind of intimacy that myself, Lynn, and the whole cast got kind of access to.
Yeah.
And everyone has their own subjective experience of John, and it kind of created this amalgamation of an idea for me, and combined with my own interpretation and my own where my imagination met his. And to be honest, I did feel like I knew him even without talking to people about him. And I think that's a testament to his work, mm-hmm. and a testament to his life, because he lived so exposed and vulnerably, and he there was nothing to hide. He wanted to be known. He wanted to be seen, and he wanted to see and know others. And but then of course, there were people were lining up around the block. Of course, we have Julie Larson, who was one of our producers, who was his surviving sister, who just, you know, I remember there was a really lovely moment at the premiere after in New York, and I gave her we had a hug, and I said, God, I wish he was here. And she said, oh, you would have gotten over that real quick if you'd actually known him. And it was like, oh, yeah, perfect. And that's what she kind of brought for us throughout the whole process, was this kind of lack of preciousness and an irreverence that felt really important, because he was so irreverent. He was such a anti-establishment kind of revolutionary artist that wanted to tear down all systems that didn't serve his friends and didn't serve the artist and didn't serve gay people. And you know, he was singing to reach the psyche of Ronald Reagan and the halls of Congress. He wasn't singing just because they were pretty songs and because he was a narcissist, but he was singing because he needed to make actual change so that his friends would survive. So yeah, it was a profound kind of research. And he was also a very ordinary guy. He was just like a regular theater kid, just kind of turned up to an 11 all the time.
You can see how much he has influenced Lynn.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the way that Lynn works now.
Totally.
As well. It was funny when I spoke to Lynn and he was talking about how there was things for him that when he was preparing things and production design and all that kind of stuff where he didn't realize how much of himself he was putting right. in there. And yeah. even the kind of flat with the keyboard and kind yeah. of, and someone going, that's exactly what your flat.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that.
Yeah.
So great.
No, totally.
So truthful. So coming from somewhere real.
Absolutely. And you know, Lynn was so useful to me because, you know, one of the things, one of the many things I needed insight on was what it is to be a writer, what it is to be a musical theater writer specifically. And as you say, I don't think there is a Lin-Manuel Miranda as we know him without Jonathan Larson, without Stephen Sondheim, to kind of, you know, in that spiritual ancestry kind of way. And yeah, Lin was created as a musical theater artist when he saw Tick, Tick, Boom off Broadway. He realized what he had to do.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible.
That kind of journey then to this.
And also the fact that before he wanted to be a musical theater maker, he wanted to be a filmmaker. And he picked up his Betamax or VHS camera when he was a kid, and that was his first love. So all of those things colliding with, you know, the musical that made him want to write music and this being his first film, like it's kind of poetic synchronicity to the max. But that's what Lin's life is, and that's what it is to live a life in line with oneself or one's soul or one's calling. And I think that is what this story is. That is Jonathan's story as well. He was someone that was so unequivocal and uncompromised and living with his own sense of inner calling and alignment, even in the face, and especially challenging in the face of rejection and failure. Because I love this story because it's a story about failure. And I think every single young artist needs to know that this isn't a rites of passage. It's an initiatory journey into the deepest possible version of what it is to be an artist and a unique artist. And I think it's, you know, we love seeing uncompromising artists depicted on screen, for sure.
How on earth did you learn to play the piano that way in a year?
I learned things by rote. I don't actually know how to play piano.
But, it's one of those skills that you learn as a, you know, as an actor. You kind of walk away from projects with new, you know, skills, new kind of intentions, new mm-hmm. just things in your backpack, really.
It's pretty cool.
It's so cool. I mean, the idea of just kind of, you know, rocking a piano where they go, yeah, I'm just going to go on there.
It's so cool. And yeah, but like, don't ask me to do more than like a few phrases of 30-90 and like the middle part of Why and Happy Birthday. Outside of that, I'm ruined. But no, I mean, like, yeah, but it took me a year to learn a couple of like Why and 30-90 just by rote, and it's all gone now. But I'm still playing, and I love playing, and I picked up guitar again, and like, it's really reinvigorated me into because I used to play guitar when I was a kid and clarinet, and I just love music so much, and to make it, and I've started writing just for fun, just kind of
music.
I wrote a song for my mom, I wrote a song for my goddaughter, and just silly stuff that no one will ever hear, but it's just like for me really
lovely outlet.
Oh, it's the best.
And gift for people as well.
We'll see. I don't know about gifts.
What about with that kind of, with the voice and finding that voice? Because this role requires so many pieces to the performance. Mm. You know, it requires the performance of this character, of your interpretation of him. It, mm-hmm. It requires the vocal presentation, the movement mm-hmm. and the piano. There's so many things that need to align mm-hmm. for it to work.
Yeah.
And you can see and you can feel your heart is so in this performance as well. It just kind of seeps out the screen. How is that? How does this compare to doing a bog standard film, but you know
bog
what?
Bog standard of, nonsense. Yeah. Non-musical. Who would make a non-musical film?
A non-musical
film
that maybe requires not quite as much kind of, you know, alignment there.
I know what you mean. I got to say, you know, there's something that Lin says privately all the time, which is like, why would anyone want to make a film that's not a musical? I don't get it. It's tongue in cheek, but he kind of means it, because it is. It's total. Mm-hmm. It's like a whole. It's like total theater. Like there's no it's so magical to be able to express oneself through all of the things that we have, you know, the whole arsenal. Yeah. And I think, like, for me, I think, to be honest, like, I remember when I first watched the first cut that Lin showed me of this film, and he very generously kind of brought me in to help, you know, shape it in the edit to whatever degree that it was useful. And he showed me it, and I saw it on my own, and I was just kind of incredibly nervous. But about 10 minutes into watching, I became myself as an 18-year-old drama student back at Central School of Speech and Drama in Swiss Cottage. Like, I became that version of Andrew, and it was like, oh, this is where I've wanted to go. This is where I've wanted, wow, when I was that age. This is the purest expression of that, of all the longings, of all of the wants, the need, the questioning of, will I make it? Won't I make it? Will we do it as a group? Like, friends of mine that are still my friends that we now look back and go, oh my gosh, like, it's been 18 years since we graduated, and look at what's happened. Look at where we've come in our lives, and also as actors and as directors and writers and as creative people. So I think there's something really magical in this film for me, because it feels like the purest expression of the first impulse I ever had as an actor. There's no holding back. Mm-hmm. It is, as you say, just heart fully on sleeve, in throat, coming out of eyeballs, you know, with pores, like every cell is bursting.
Yeah.
And that is, of course, the character. That's John. So, like, for John, it's not a musical. It's just life for John. Because John will sing and dance and play piano when words aren't enough and when emotions can't be expressed in any other way. It's as natural as breathing. And I think there's a part of me that feels that way too, where it's not performance. It's just expression. And I think for me, growing up in Surrey, and, you know, in a quite a stuffy, you know, middle class kind of area of England, there was a terror in all of my emotional life that I felt wasn't welcome. It was very Truman Show, you know. I think we all experience that to a degree wherever we're brought up. Like, and then it's on us to figure out whether we can find the safe spaces to find our full expression. So for me, like, I think this is a real kind of a coming out thing for me, in the sense of, like, oh no, there's that is the rawest, most vulnerable, like, nerve ending, like, on the outside of the skin kind of thing. Like, I'll never be more vulnerable on screen. And I'm just so, and it has to do with the singing, the dancing, but also has to do with how John lived, really.
Yeah. What's your most memorable number from the film?
Oh, man. They're all so memorable in their own ways.
They're very different, though.
So different, yeah. I love all of them. Like, I love the opening. I love 3090 so much, because it's such a freight train that you have to somehow figure out how to be in control of. It's a Billy Joel kind of piano pounding kind of epic that he's playing to, like, three people, you know, in his living room and in New York Theatre Workshop. Stop the clock, take time out, time to regroup before you lose the bout. Freeze the frame. Treading water, but the riptide's getting stronger. Don't panic, don't jump ship, can't fight it like taxes. At least it happens only once in your life. They're singing happy birthday, you just want to lay down and cry. Not just another birthday, it's 3090. Why can't you stay 29? Hell, you still feel like then, like, I don't know, Johnny Can't Decide is such a sweet, tender kind of Ben Folds-y kind of,
nice.
You know, I love that song. And then obviously No More, that duet with Robin is just pure like joy, B-52s kind of like, you know, wild punk rock.
Throwing down the key because there is no buzzer. No more faulty wiring, no more crooked floors, no more spitting out my ultra bright on top of dirty dishes in the one and only sink.
And then, you know, Why is a really, obviously really emotional song. And I think that one always, that one will stick with me forever because of it's so personal to me in that moment and shooting it. And it's a little kind of time capsule of a kind of a ritualistic experience of of getting deeper into life, of really getting into the muck and mire of life, like going from boyhood to manhood, yeah. I think, where one of the things we have to accept as if we're lucky enough to have the experience, that we have to really acknowledge that we're not here for a long time and that loss is just as important as all of the highs of gain and success. That actually loss and an acknowledgement that this is a short sacred ride is the only thing that actually gives the moment of breathing between birth and death any meaning. Like, and I think that's what John is going through in real time, and I'm just very, very grateful that we managed to kind of capture it on film.
When I was 9, Michael and I entered a talent show down at the Y. 9 a.m. went to rehearse by some stairs. Mike couldn't sing, but I said, no one cares. We sang, Yellow Bird, and let's go fly a kite. Over and over and over, till we got it right. The YMCA, 3 o'clock sun had made the grass. Hey, I thought, hey, what a way to spend a day. Hey, what a way to spend a day. I make a vow. Right here and now, I'm gonna spend my time this way.
Prior to this, where did music sit in terms of for you with work? Did it have a purpose for roles or for?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, like I always make a playlist for every character I play, and sometimes it will be, and it's very, very personal. Or there will be like a playlist for a moment. There'll be a playlist for a day on set, a scene.
Oh, wow.
And it would be very weird songs that no one else would understand why it connects with this moment. But yeah, I mean, it's the most, I think music is the most vital thing in terms of emotional memory and in terms of pulling up feelings and recollections from the past. You know exactly where you were and what was going on with specific songs. So, and it's an incredibly useful tool, especially when you're on set and you're struggling with getting down to an emotional place that the character is living within or experiencing, and then a song will just take you directly there. Yeah, absolutely. It's always been, you know, vital in terms of work, but in terms of life, it's like, you know, that's why Desert Island Discs is just the greatest podcast of all time. It's like. That's why it's the most emotional kind of interview format that I've ever when you listen to Tom Hanks talking about where he was and the song that reminds him of the end of loneliness, as he said, our indelible moments from Desert Island Discs,
yeah,
related to certain songs that people select.
Do you have a song associated that's not part of the film with Tick, Tick, Boom?
I mean, there are a lot of songs from Rent that I have associated with it, but honestly, there's a song that really sums up my kind of commitment, that symbolizes a moment in my life of really a galvanized commitment and of understanding what I had to do with my life, which is a song by Don McLean called Vincent,
yeah,
about Van Gogh.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray, look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills, sketch the trees and the daffodils, catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now.
And that song, and I won't go into all the details, but I advise people to listen to it because it's a song about what it is to be an artist, and it's a song about Jonathan Larson, actually, as much as it's a song about Van Gogh, and it's as much as it's a song about any artist who felt too sensitive for this world, and any artist that has ever experienced failure and rejection, and still go out of bed and put their shoulder to the wheel of what they felt called to anyway. And thank God, you know, I think about that all the time. I think about Van Gogh and I think about John. I'm like, God, if they had woken up one morning going, oh, you know what? Maybe everyone's right. Maybe I should just give up. The world would be a far less rich place. And I think I find that so deeply moving because, like, obviously I've received a lot of encouragement in my life in terms of, and you know, that kind of outward validation and success to keep me doing what I love doing and what I feel called to do. But, like, I don't know if I would have had the strength without that kind of reflection.
Yeah.
Of people going, oh no, what you're doing is good, keep doing it. I don't know if I would have had the courage that John Larson had or that Vincent Van Gogh had to get up and paint and get up and play. But I'm just so impressed and in awe that their output was so prolific in the face of such rejection and failure.
Yeah. I'm really intrigued though that this has unlocked something in you, and I really hope that you embrace these new skills that you've learned in some way, shape, or form. What kind of music are you writing? I want to know what you'd compare it to. Are we talking Arcade Fire, Ben Folds 5? What are we talking? Because you've got good taste, I can tell.
I don't know if... I'm not sure.
Where would it sit in the genre? In the genre bin in the record store, where would it sit?
I have no objectivity. I guess it would be kind of folky. I guess it would be... kind of it's very naive. It's very naive. It's very sweet. There's a kind of an innocent it might even be just like in the genre of like kids music. I'm not sure.
Nothing wrong with that.
Be like kids folk.
Kids folk, I like that. There was somebody wrote an album for kids music, and I can't remember who it was. It was someone like This Is the Kit or something.
I don't know.
It was amazing. It was like music written specifically for kids, but not kind of like kids TV music,
sure,
but serious kids, if that makes
sense. Yeah.
It was really interesting.
Serious kids music.
Colors of something it was called. I'll find out what it was anyway. Can I just have one question about Spider-Man?
Of course. Yeah.
Because, I mean, you're a great liar. That's
Thank
what the
you.
World now knows,
Thank
isn't
you.
It?
Yeah.
You can keep a secret. I mean, what was your reaction when it was going, look, are you up for it?
Yeah.
Do you want to do this?
It took me a minute. It took me a minute because I'd really put it to bed, and I, you know, when you close a chapter on something and you really, you know, it's like you know, the ex-girlfriend that breaks up with you just when you're starting to feel like you're getting over it. Yeah, and it comes. The phone vibrates at 1 a.m. just when you're having your first good sleep. And I mean, it was really interesting. It was totally unexpected. There was not one part of me that thought I would ever be asked to put on the spandex again. And to be frank, when I heard what the idea was, I was kind of like, oh man, yeah, that's great. That's like, no, there's no way I'm not going to participate in that. Yeah. If Toby's going, I'm going.
Yeah.
And as long as, you know, there was definitely caveats. I'm not really interested if it's just going to be like a hi and then I'm out of there. Like, no one needs that. Like, that's just kind of, but if it could be of service to Tom's journey as Peter Parker, and if it was going to be fun, then it was kind of a yes. It was kind of an easy yes. And John Watts, such a great director. Like, he's a really legitimately great director. And I heard the pitch and I was like, this is funny.
Yeah.
And fun. And it was just the beginning as well. That was the other key. He was like, and I want to create it with you guys. I don't know what it is yet exactly, but I want you guys to bring all That's of awesome. Yourselves to it. And I want to find it with everyone. And I was like, oh, okay, that sounds great. So it was really that.
That's brilliant. Yeah. What's next?
I am going to rest a bit. I'm going to chill and I'm going to, you know, have a bit of a life again. And it's been busy, which is strange during the pandemic, because I know that it's been the opposite of that for so many people. So I feel very lucky that I've gotten to do what I've loved to do. And I you know, like the rest of actors at the beginning of the pandemic, it was like, oh gosh, this idea of being non-essential was very, very confronting. Like, while my brother was on the front lines at the old at the Royal Brompton Hospital in Chelsea, just saving lives, I was with everyone else. We were all just sitting on our couches, just being good citizens and taking care of each other. So I think that was very, very confronting at the beginning of the pandemic for us artists, and having to do like theater Zoom things, that was really painful. But now I'm really, I have a TV show coming out, a mini series based on the book Under the Banner of Heaven, which is a true crime story, which is, I think, could be really very, very exciting, very, very strange and thrilling, kind of page turning stuff. It's a John Krakauer book adapted by Dustin Lance Black, who's a Mormon. So it's set in the Mormon community back in the 80s in Utah, these really gruesome murders that happen within the Mormon community. And it's an unpicking of the Mormon religion and how men can become narcissists with God complexes and be killing people in the name of God. It's really fascinating. Wow. True crime story, and should be, I don't know, it's weird. True crime has become like a comfort genre for people over the course of the last 2 years, which I find very interesting. People will be able to add it to their comfort watch lists.
Great.
Yeah.
Death. Yeah. Comfort list.
Exactly. Yeah.
Listen, it's great to chat to you.
You too.
And congratulations again on this. And I wish you so much luck for the Oscars as well. That nomination is so deserving.
Thank
and
you.
I hope to see you up there with Bless a great you. Speech again. Oh. Rewatched your boy. Acceptance speech, actually.
When I was 12 years old.
It was brilliant. Bloody good speech.
I was so out of
you
it.
You were great.
I had no idea. I was never going to win that. It should have been Anthony
Scher
or Tom Hardy. And it was like, no, not the kid. They voted for the kid. But thank you. You're the best. And thank you for the support with this film. And yeah, love talking to you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Cheers, mate.
I feel bad that you feel bad about me feeling bad about you feeling bad about what I said, about what you said, about me not being able to share a feeling.
If I thought that what you thought was that I thought about sharing my thoughts, then my reaction to your reaction to my reaction would have been more revealing.
From Tick Tick Boom, that's Therapy by Andrew Garfield and Vanessa Hudgens, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin'.
My huge thanks to Andrew for taking the time to talk to us. Tick, Tick, Boom is available to stream now on Netflix, and we wish him every success at the Oscars. If you want to listen to my chat with Lin-Manuel Miranda, head to edithbowman.com. You're welcome. Or your preferred podcast provider. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. Where you'll also find nearly 300 other episodes with luminaries from the world of film, television and music. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do tell everyone you know about us if you like what you hear. Next up, at the beginning of next week, it is none other, oh, can't believe this, than Johnny Greenwood. Yes, it is. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.